And we will jiggle the alignment up around here a little bit and start a public hearing on House Bill 2395. Janet, can you give us a brief summation of it?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Members, House Bill 2395 was introduced at the request of Representative McPherson and would allow local governments to invest funds that are set aside through their deferred compensation programs in shares of stock, including but not limited to shares of mutual funds. If you look at the bill, that the amendment language, the key amendment language is at the bottom of page 3, the bolded language, adding a 12th item that local governments are authorized to invest in, and the wording is shares of stock of any company, association, or corporation, including but not limited to shares of a mutual fund, but only if the monies being invested are funds set aside pursuant to a local government deferred compensation plan. Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson is here in the audience. And
thank you, Janet. Representative McPherson. Thank you, sir, for bringing him this morning.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Brown. For the record, I'm Greg McPherson, State Representative for House District 38, and this is a bill that I sponsored at the request of some people who work with deferred compensation programs for local governments. And I wanted just to give you a kind of an orienting overview so you understand what the issue is here, because it's not probably not very readily apparent on the surface of the statute. First of all, the deferred compensation plans in question are ones that are under a particular section of the Federal Internal Revenue Code. It happens to be Section 457. And what it does is it allows public employees to elect to reduce their pay and have those monies invested, like in a 401k plan, until they retire. And so, well, the statute in question deals with municipal or local government finance, it's really a question of public employee finance. That is, what investment vehicles are going to be available to our public employees so that they can get the best return over the long pull. Now, people who are experienced in investing know that over the longer pull, you get stronger returns by having some component of stock investments in your portfolio. You do better over time. Even though you may lose ground at certain times, you're going to do better, you know, through several market cycles if you can access stock. Now, the way these plans used to work was that it was a requirement of the federal tax law that the assets had to be held as general assets of the employer. So even though they were in an account that where the employee was really the one at risk as to whether the investments did well or poorly, it was technically governmental money, and so it was subject to the restrictions that apply to how governmental money can be invested. And there is a provision of the Oregon Constitution that forbids, with certain exceptions, governmental money from being invested in stocks. And it's a throwback to the market problems of the 1930s. There was a change in federal tax law in the mid-1990s that required that these kinds of plan assets be held in a trust account, and that solved the constitutional problem. As long as the assets are held in trust, as is required under federal law, then it's not an Oregon constitutional problem. The state's statewide deferred compensation plan that's run out of the treasurer's office was then revised in the 1997 session to conform to this new provision of law and to hold the assets in trust. And at the same time, there was an authorization to invest directly in those trust assets in stock, which is an important advance, because before, stock investments were being made, but they were being made through certain kinds of insurance vehicles where there was a middleman. There was somebody else who was getting a cut of the return, so the employee was experiencing a lower return than he really should have been getting because he was paying an extra cost in the middle of that process. That was cured by back in 1997 for the state's program, but a parallel change was not made for local government deferred compensation plans, and that's what why we're here today. It's to get a parallel fix made for local government deferred compensation plans, and local governments can sponsor their own Section 457 deferred compensation plans, just as the state treasurer's office has one for state employees and local governments that choose to access that one. So this is to give our public employees a more efficient, a better priced investment vehicle available to them by being able to invest their deferred compensation monies directly into stock-based investments. Mainly it's mutual funds we're concerned about, because that's an efficiently priced vehicle that pools together different types of investments, but it is in fact stock that you own when you buy a mutual fund, so it would be otherwise prohibited without this change. Now, there was a technical change raised just yesterday by the Treasurer's Office about the fact that there's not a statute that says, in Oregon, that says that these local government deferred compensation plan assets need to be held in trust, as there is for the statewide program. And in response to that, it's our intention to have an amendment prepared by Legislative Council to specifically acknowledge that these assets will be held in trust. That's what everybody expected was happening anyway, because it's a requirement of the federal tax law. So there was no thought that we would be doing it other than through a trust. But just so it's explicitly recognized on the face of the statute, we'll be having an amendment prepared to this language to acknowledge that element. So that's kind of a once over the ground. I have to go to another meeting here, but before I leave and before I turn it over to these people who know the nuts and bolts of this, I'd like to respond to any questions.
Thank you, Representative. Are these funds ever matched in any way by the local government?
Chair Brown, they can be matched. I think it's fairly unusual for them to be matched, even though it's like a 401k plan. Really, it's sort of a 401k plan for public employees. And in 401k plans, it's very common for the employer to match the funds, but it's much less common for the public employee deferred compensation plans to have an employer match.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, thank you. I was talking to one of my public employee friends. Now, currently, you can be a public employee, and this money goes through a state fund, and they can do this. But if you're in a local government, you may not be able to do it because your government, whatever it is you work for, isn't hooked into a state fund. Is that so? Some public employees can already do this through the state.
And yes, right? Chair Brown, Representative Schaffler. All public employees, both state and local, whose employers have chosen to provide this as a benefit, and most have this vehicle available to them. So employees can elect to reduce their pay and have the assets invested for retirement in that deferred compensation plan. The only difference at this point is that the state program is permitted to invest directly in corporate stock, including the stock of mutual funds, which is the main opportunity that needs to be accessed because it's how you get efficiently priced investments. But the local government plans don't have statutory authority to invest directly in stock. They have to invest through another vehicle, and they do. Mm-hmm. They pay a middleman to provide, use typically an insurance product that has mutual funds inside of it. You pay the money to an insurance company, which then invests the money in a mutual fund and gives you the return on the mutual fund minus a cut for having provided this vehicle. And it's a service that they provide, and it's one that's because it costs them administration that they should properly pay for. But it means there's an extra cost load that the employees are is diminishing their returns.
So just so I get this clear, Representative, because you're so clear on it, and make it so, when we do this, it'll be to the benefit of those folks in the latter program.
Absolutely. This does not hurt anybody who's in the state program because they have this opportunity available to them now. But the people who are in the local government programs, it will improve the returns for our local government public employees because they won't be paying this cost load in order to be able to access indirectly an investment that we should let them invest in directly.
Thank you.
And by local government, we mean cities, counties, special districts?
Right. All of the above.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McPherson, I think this is a good idea. I really like it. I just have a question. Nothing prevents a local government from investing in, say, two or even one individual stock of a company. I mean, I see it, you know, most prudent governments would invest in mutual funds, but they could still invest in just one company with stocks with this plan as well, could they not?
Chair Brown, Representative Holby, in theory, an investment could be made in a single issue of stock. In fact, it's not a risk of the public employer. It's a decision made by that employer and whoever is operating their plan about what investment opportunities to make available to the employees, because the employees are the ones who are ultimately at risk. And in all the programs that I'm familiar with, it's always pooled investment vehicles. In fact, to offer up to employees the option of buying an individual issue of stock would be, I think, a poor plan design, and I'm not aware of any governmental entity that does that, because it's turning people loose to with the risk that they're going to become undiversified. And diversification, that is how you moderate your risk in these programs, by investing through a pooled fund, generally a mutual fund, in a whole lot of different stocks. Then if one goes up, another one's going down, and it kind of moderates, and you get the sort of the general flow of the market.
Follow up?
No, that's all right.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McPherson, the one thing that comes to mind is you're talking primarily of investing in mutual funds for the exact reason that you just said. What goes up, goes down, moderates it. What happens if these mutual funds dissipate and they do go away? You know, let's say that the majority of the, you know, they don't become solvent anymore, and they're not. Is there a backup here for these, or is it, you know, that's question one. Question two to that question would be, is it only mutual funds that they would be able to invest in, or are there other parameters, higher risk options that the employee could opt for?
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts. Let's take the second piece of that first. The statute would not limit them to just mutual funds.
Okay.
Because it would allow investment in stocks, and that's necessary in order to access mutual funds, which are the predominant way that you get into diversified pools of assets. Because those are stock based. That is, the owner an interest in a mutual fund owns shares in a corporation, and that corporation is the mutual fund. Remind me the first part of the question now.
There are cases where obviously where mutual funds have not been solvent. Is there a safeguard there for the public employee that has chose to invest in?
The employees are at the risk of the marketplace, as anybody is in a 401k plan or any other individual account plan. That is, they can do rise and fall with whatever the performance is of the marketplace, and that's been the design of this kind of deferred compensation plan all along. And the idea is that the government isn't, the governmental entity that sponsors it isn't putting itself at risk. It is simply making a vehicle available to the employee so the employee can access an efficiently priced return, and it's a better way to invest for the employee because it's tax deferred. They can invest 100 cents on that deferred dollar until retirement when they take it out, and then they pay tax, as opposed to not going through this deferred compensation plan when they would get taxed, say, 30, 40 cents on the dollar, and it's only the remaining 60 or 70 cents that they get to invest. So it's a win-win for the employee and the employer, because the employee is getting a pre-tax return, and if you have the opportunity to invest that money that would otherwise be paid in tax currently, your retirement funds grow faster.
Sure. Thank you.
Representative, you've answered one of my questions, was the tax deferred. So these are pre-tax dollars that are going into the account. And then while they're in this trust, they're still not taxed. The only time they're subject to tax is when they come out, when they draw them out.
Right? Yes, Chair Brown, that's exactly right. The general characteristic of what we call deferred compensation is you earn it now, but you postpone, you defer the time that you take it out until a later time, and you're not taxed until that time. And it is why retirement plans of various kinds, including these 457 plans, are so important as retirement vehicles because of that, the economics I was just describing. You're using the money that would otherwise be paid in tax currently, and you're getting to invest that money in the meantime, and it will grow much faster than if you have to pay tax at the front end and you're only investing an after-tax dollar.
Is there any limit placed on how much an employee can place in these funds?
Yes, Chair Brown. There is a statutory limit set in the Federal Internal Revenue Code on the amount that can be put in each year.
15%, like?
No, Chair Brown, it is... it's a dollar figure that I think is about in the low teens, 12 or 13, $14,000 this year. It's going up kind of 18.
It goes to 15 next year.
15,000. I'm advised by my expert here at my side that that corresponds to the same limit. I think it's the same limit that applies to 401k plans. And again, one way of thinking about this vehicle is that this is like a 401k plan for public employees. It's an individual account plan where the individual makes a decision to set money aside and invest it in a vehicle that they choose and get that return compounding on a pre-tax basis, and then take it out and pay tax only at retirement.
In the university system, they have a 401k plan, or similar to a 401k, or they can have. Can they do this deferred compensation in addition to that plan?
Chair Brown, I'm not positive about the answer to that. What the university system has that's special is what they call the optional retirement plan, which is an alternative to the PERS system. That is, an employee can choose not to go into PERS, and instead to go into the optional retirement plan, which is the same percentage of pay that the university employer would have paid into PERS. And it's invested in an individual account like these monies. And I believe the answer is they can do this amount on top of that. But I'm not positive. Okay.
And the value of those type of retirement plans that they have in the university is they can carry those with them as they move from job to job or out of the state. Can they also take this with them?
Yes, Chair Brown. These monies are what we call in the trade portable. That is, they can be moved around as you move from one employer to another, because they can be rolled over tax free. You can direct that the plan that you were investing through, if you've left that employer, that those monies will be moved directly into the plan maintained by your new employer.
I know you have to be in another committee, so I'll allow Representative Schaffer one more question.
Just these monies, though, they're for any average public employee, that's true for them, too, if they're portable for them, too?
Chair Brown, Representative Schaffer, yes, these monies are portable. I mean, the individual local government plan would have to use that portability opportunity that is allowed under the federal tax code, but I think that all of them do, because an employer generally doesn't want to be holding and be responsible for money that is for somebody who used to work there. They'd rather that money were taken to someplace else so where that employee can more actively communicate with them.
All kinds of trouble happens when the government hangs on to it.
Not good.
Some good, some not so good.
Thank you, Representative.
Okay, thank you very much. I will leave now and leave it in the hands of colleagues who know more about this and the details than I do.
Thank you again. Which one of you want to start? Jason, Greg?
I'm sensitive to your time here, so I think at this point Congressman McPherson has been very thorough, so if you have additional questions, I will take them. But
could I get you to state your name for the record so we got it on the tape?
My name is Jason Davidson.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Fair, who are you with?
I work for Arnrich Messina and Associates.
Thank you. Greg?
For the record, Greg Settle with the ICMA Retirement Corporation. We administer these deferred compensation plans for over 60 local governments here in the state of Oregon, and I'd be happy to take any questions you have on this issue.
I think we grilled Representative McPherson so thoroughly, we probably a few questions about Representative Shields.
Can I just ask a quick question? Is there anything in this that you think would allow people to gamble more on the stock market and potentially risk, repeat some of the things that happened with PGE and Enron? Could somebody invest 80% in one company, or are most of these plans set up with different risk pools? How do they operate in the day-to-day world?
Representative Shields, basically the requirements for the individual entity as a fiduciary, meaning they're holding the responsibility to the participants and what vehicles they make available to the employees, stays. So you still have the same requirement for the individual entity to make sure that their participants are provided with the proper tools to make the necessary decisions to build for their retirement. As Congressman McPherson mentioned, the primary interest here is opening up an array of mutual funds that are not constrained by those mutual funds that are only offered through a third party or a wrap or an annuity insurance type of thing. So basically the primary investment vehicle will be a pool, i.e. a mutual fund, as an option for participants. And the hope is a less expensive mutual fund, because that additional third party requirement is no longer there. Conceivably, you could offer to participants the ability to invest in an individual security. Most plans do not do that.
Thank you.
Any other questions for these people?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Schomburg.
Just a comment. My friend, Representative McPherson, isn't congressman yet, but we hope someday he will be. I broke out in a sweat.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
I got a few people that would object to that.
Tony?
Good luck.
Mr. Chair is going to make a comment.
Go ahead, Janet.
Mr. Chair, the committee might be interested that a bill has passed the Senate that would allow the state treasurer to invest PERS and industrial accident fund monies in stocks, as well as some of the other things they can, including deferred comp. So that is another move in the same direction at the state level for different funds. I just thought that might be of interest to the committee. Thank you.
Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, Chair Brown, members of the committee. My name is Tony Bita, and I represent Lane County in front of the Oregon Legislature, and I appreciate the opportunity this morning to share with you some perspective on the attributes of House Bill 2395, and just wanted to validate some of the perspective already given by Representative McPherson in terms of how local government utilizes what is currently available and would benefit from the changes and the additional opportunities available if the restriction in statute were to be removed. The two primary concerns, again, of the existing options, and we do offer through to our 1,500 employees in Lane County deferred compensation plans through one of two insurance carriers, and there's good participation right now among our employee base in those plans, but they have limitations, and the limitations were already mentioned. Number one, in terms of being able for the employee to match their risk, their appetite for risk, with investment options that are appropriate to that, and this has a lot to do with where they're at in their life and in their career and how close they are to retirement. The investment options available through those insurance carriers are fairly limited. And then the second limitation is, of course, that there is additional fees and additional administrative costs associated with making those deferred compensation contributions through the existing insurance carriers. Right now, talking to our benefits people in Lane County, and I don't want to overblow this because it's substantial and yet not something that's a huge problem, but right now it's a little over 0.5% a year is what we estimate would be the administrative costs associated with investing through these insurance carriers. So, for example, on a $10,000 account balance, you would pay about $55 a year for administration under the current configuration. We believe that with the passage of House Bill 2395, our employees could avail themselves to investment options that would have a lower cost in terms of what is borne by the individual investor on a year-over-year basis. And even a few basis points reduction over the life of 20-25-year employee adds up to a lot more financial security for the employee upon retirement. And that's really the third point that I want to close with, is that the primary virtues of expanding the options and lowering the management costs for employees is that upon retirement, they have hopefully a financial nest egg that provides them more security and ultimately reduces their potential claims on public services or public dollars. I'd be glad to take any questions.
Thank you. Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning.
So, just so I'm clear on this, Lane County employees actually have a choice of different plans that they can invest in with their deferred compensation. Is it the employee's choice?
Their choice is one or the other or both of two insurance carriers. The insurance carriers have their own portfolios that once you subscribe to that carrier, you're locked into what the insurance carrier's portfolio is. So no, you do not have the option to say, well, within this insurance carrier that I've subscribed to, I would like to see that 25% of my money goes toward high cap, 30% goes to international, 50% goes to high tech. No, you do not have those options. Your investment is reflecting the portfolio held by the insurance carrier.
But there are different different plans. You say there's two different plans that they can choose from?
Yes, two different insurance carriers that currently provide a deferred compensation benefit through Lane County to our employees. Chair Brown, Representative Holvey.
Thank you. I guess what I was trying to get at is that the employee does have an option to pick or choose a different risk associated with the different plans that are covered by the insurance carriers.
Chair Brown, Representative Holvey, you're now asking me beyond my ability to analyze. Isn't in fact the risk and return attributes of those two different insurance carriers significantly different or variable in any way at all? And I do not have that information. That's something that the experts from the financial marketplace would want to offer to you.
Is there any other questions, Tony? Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Is there anyone else that would, wishes to testify on House Bill 2395? No. There is some an issue raised by the treasurer's office that there may be a constitutional issue with this that Representative McPherson believes he can fix with an amendment to the bill, and so we'll hold this over. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2395. And I'll open a work session to introduce some committee bills. And what did I do with my list? There it is. We have LC 3138, 2579, 3009, 1912, 1255 to be as possible committee bills. Does somebody have a list? Well, 1259, excuse me.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, can you repeat that list one more time, please? I don't have anything to add.
Can you read it off there?
Yeah, I'm 1759.
Oh, I can't read my own writing. It's 1759.
LC 1759, LC 1912, LC 3009, LC 2579, and LC 3138.
Are you looking?
No, there's two more in your stack today that will not be introduced today. There was a correction that needed to be made on one, and one may not need to be introduced. So
okay.
We'll try to get those back from you before you leave. But that's the five ones that we just listed.
Looking for a motion?
Yes, Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move the committee adopt or for committee bill purposes, LC 1759, 1912, 3009, 2579, 3138 as committee bills.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Kitts moves me. 1759, 1912, 3009, 2579, and 3138 as committee bills. Is there any objection? Seeing none, they're introduced as committee bills. Let's see.
This will be easy.
The top one. Okay, I want to open the work session on House Bill 2098, and Janet, can you review it with us again, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2098 was introduced at the request, pre-session filed at the request of the State Board of Architect Examiners. The hearing on this bill was held on January 31st, so you may have to dust off your memory bank. The bill has minimal fiscal impact. It would allow the Board of Architect Examiners to assess a person for the expenses the board incurs in taking action against the person. The bill also deletes a requirement that a written complaint to the board be in the form of a sworn statement, and there's an obsolete reference to criminal prosecution that was taken out. Mr. Chair, on the January 31st, the only testimony was from Carol Halford of the Board of Architect Examiners, and she's in the audience today to answer any questions. There's no opposing testimony. I've had verbal support from the American Institute of Architects, who are the Association of the Regulated People under the board. The costs, I was going to mention that the costs of the board taking action against a person would include specifically in the bill expert witness fees, administrative law judge expenses, and board attorney fees. Mr. Chair, if you have the bill in front of you, quite a few of the several sections were rewritten. So in bold on line 6 on the first page of the bill is a $5,000 civil penalty. I just wanted to point out to some members that's an existing civil penalty. It's just taken out of a section on page 2, line 21. So that's an existing civil penalty. The new language is actually lines 7 through 9 on the first page, starting with, in addition to imposing a civil penalty, the board may assess against and recover from the person any expenses of the board associated with the taking of action by the board against the person. And so that's where the main part of the bill is. You should have in your folders from the meeting the testimony of the board chair, William Sider.
Carol, could I have you come up, please, for a moment? Thank you.
Good morning.
Probably a question that I should have asked during the hearing, but this seems like a really hefty penalty, you know, pretty substantial. What kind of offense would these people be doing that deserves this kind of slap alongside the head?
Well, Chair Brown, members of the committee, the most common offense is really practicing architecture without a license, but it also includes professional misconduct by architects.
Like designing a building that fell down? Or
exactly. That hasn't happened recently, but we've had a couple of revocations, suspension in the last 5-6 years. We don't have a large amount of professional misconduct. We've also had some that were involving misrepresentation, and those would be included.
Representative Esquivel, in testimony, I believe, in public hearing, had asked the question regarding should an architect be, you know, brought forward to and possibly, you know, be facing this type of fine? Should it go in their favor that their costs could be recovered?
Well, Chair Brown, members of the committee, the initial reason that the board believed when they put forth this bill that was the case, that it was reciprocal, and they understood that was the risk. If the other party won, that they would be eligible for recovery costs as well. However, we've come to learn since then that is not the case. That only happens in certain civil courts and et cetera, but not in administrative law. It has to be specifically in there. The board is not opposed to putting that in. That was their belief initially.
Okay, thank you. Representative Chalfworth.
Thanks. I'm not opposed to this. I'm just, this is a curious question. I think it was Fred Myers that had the ice load on top of it collapse 2 Januaries ago. Would that be something along these lines, or would the engineer be responsible, architect? Who's?
This is, Vice Chair Schaffler, Chair Brown. This would cover only the administrative law piece. So if they take an architect or an engineer, for that matter, to court for some matter, cost recovery, usually contractual issues, this doesn't apply. It only applies if someone files a complaint with the board and we find that the person had violated some piece of our law.
Representative Kitts.
Just for clarification, maybe I'm reading this incorrectly, and if I am, you can just clarify. It states the state board may impose a civil penalty not to exceed $5,000 for each offense. In addition to that $5,000, it can assess, and I don't need to read it, but lines 8 through 10, so basically costs that are incurred to the board as a result of proceeding forward. Two questions. Number one, how is it derived at what that fine will be? It says up to, not to exceed $5,000, so I'm assuming by the language it could be $4,000, could be $3,000. How is it determined what that civil penalty will be assessed at?
Representative Kitts, Chair Brown, the board takes into consideration each case separately and considers the circumstances of each one and makes a decision after they find that a person had violated the law what is a worthy penalty amount for that. That is a separate issue of whether or not the board is going to recover its costs in the matter. We've had cases where we've spent $20,000 on expert witnesses to pursue a case, and certainly no civil penalty for one offense would cover that. For several offenses, it might. So if we assessed, and we don't know, I should say, going in, how much it's going to cost to defend or pursue a case either. So the civil penalty is based solely on what the wrongdoing was.
Follow-up, if I may?
Follow-up. Yeah.
So walk me through this. If I have a charge brought against me, come before you, we litigate it out, or we discuss it, whatever the case may be. Let's say your costs that are incurred to you, the board, are $2,397. You could still assess me a fine of up to $5,000 by this language. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And you could also get those costs back.
That's correct. So if the board assessed a civil penalty of $5,000, it could also assess the $2,579.
So where does that penalty go? What fund does that money go, the civil penalty, where does that money go?
This the architect board is a semi-independent agency of the state, and our funds are separate from the rest of the state's funds. They go into our bank account.
Okay.
And so basically we're getting reimbursed for the expenses that it took to prosecute that case.
Mr. Chair, I would just, my only concern with the way this language reads is it really gives understanding that costs are incurred as a result of this action, the cost that would be incurred could be infinite, whatever the dollar amount, fill in the blank. By this bill, they could then get that money back from the person who the charge is brought against and assess a fee to go into an account to do whatever, assuming, you know, probably cover the if you were to lose a case, they'd probably pay it out of that as well. My only concern in any legislation like this is it really gives the board or the government in this case a lot of incentive to win the case. And I think that then starts to go on the contrary of what becomes good policy versus witch hunt mentalities. And that's my only concern. And I don't accuse you of that, and please don't take it that way. But when it becomes, there's no definition of how you derive at $5,000. You could say $5,000 for anybody. I mean, it could be the smallest of infractions, but you're going to teach me a lesson, or you didn't like the tie that I wore to that hearing. $5,000. There's no... And in my case, that may be the case with a lot of the ties that I do wear. But that causes me just a little concern and a little reservation.
Well, Representative Kitts and Chair Brown, the civil penalty is assessed long before we ever go to the equivalent of a trial. So the civil penalty is based solely on the extent of the wrongdoing. The cost recovery is after the fact. So the civil penalty, the board right now has the authority to assess $5,000 for anything. The board takes into consideration, though, the severity of the offense in assessing the civil penalty, and we've assessed a $250 civil penalty. We've also assessed a $5,000 per incident penalty. So it's not generally just automatic that a $5,000 penalty is assessed.
Mr. Chair, I would just, if I could, one more comment. I would like to see, make sure that the language in here is reciprocal to the people, you know, that are there.
We're
so
people. Yeah.
And let them get $5,000 out of them if they're wrong.
I think you answered one of our questions here that about the history of the civil penalty amounts. You said in $250 to an upper figure of some kind. Is there an appeal from your decisions?
Yes, Chair Brown. Whether we're a semi-independent agency or not, the state all goes through the same legal processes following the APA guidelines. We use the Department of Justice as our representative, and we follow those procedures. The individual is told what the board is proposing to assess a penalty for some wrongdoing. They have a chance to request a hearing if they want, or they default by not doing anything, and then we just obtain the civil penalty if that was the action that the board took. After they do request a hearing, they can go to a hearing. They can win or lose, just as we can. After that, if they do lose, they can appeal through the Supreme Court.
The court,
yes.
Okay, thank you. Reverend Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to be clear that the civil penalties that you're collecting from these cases you know, given there not very often, but that $5,000 penalty isn't just used by the board to go out to dinners and things like that. Those penalties are used for the administration and enforcement of these laws only. Is that correct?
Yes, Representative Holt, Chair Brown, the penalties are used for legal cases, and you can look at our budget, see how we spend our money. As a semi-independent agency, we don't have access to the emergency board, and so we have to support ourselves. And so we're trying to make sure that we don't, you know, eventually go bankrupt should something happen. We need to make sure that we have the ability to pursue cases, which is what we're designated to do, against violators, and then make sure that we can support ourselves in the process.
Thank you.
Representative,
I know, but just for the record, I mean, this board, like many other boards we have, are just made up of experts in this field, I would assume. And are they appointed by the governor?
Yes, Vice Chair. The members are five architects and two public members, and they are all appointed by the governor.
And I'd imagine there's some kind of charter that you're put together to create and let me see what's the word I'm looking for. Create standards and enforce them for the safety and health and well-being of the community, and also to protect, I'd imagine, your trade as well. So it ain't a bunch of, what I'm trying to get to is, ain't a bunch of good old boys trying out there to make sure they get their pals on jobs. And
that is correct.
I mean, and how many cases have there been in the last year?
Complaint cases. I probably have that information here, but 20 to 30. I'm guessing 20.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Not that many.
And out of how many architects and projects, and then how many of those were actually assessed a civil penalty and had to pay costs?
We have approximately six to ten cases last year that were assessed a civil penalty.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the exact figures on how much.
And
with me.
And how many architects in Oregon?
There's about 2,500 architects, and we have about 400 architectural firms. Mm-hmm. Half of those reside in Oregon. Half of them are outside of Oregon doing business in Oregon.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Carol.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Committee, I'm going to hold the bill over and get some amendments drafted that Representative Esquivel suggested, and then we'll bring it back to look at them and consider them. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2098 and open the work session on House Bill 2097.
Yeah.
Members, House Bill 2097 was requested by the State Landscape Contractors Board, and you held a hearing on this bill on February 11th. The measure creates an arborist's license and consolidates the licensing of arborists under the Oregon Landscape Contractors Board. The bill does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee, and during the hearing on the bill, there was no negative testimony. You probably have some of the testimony from the landscape supporting the bill from arborists and landscape contractors. This is another bill that had quite a bit of cleanup language and rewriting and grammatical changes. Many sections were moved or reworded. The main sections of the bill I've highlighted in a new version of the procedure summary that says -2 at the top. So those sections are where the meat of the bill is, if you want to look through them. Mr. Chair, we routed yesterday a proposed -2 amendment. This does include the amendment that was discussed at the hearing, which includes stump removal in the list of activities that do not require an arborist license if the stump removal is performed by a construction contractor in conjunction with a construction or remodeling job. And the Dash 2 amendments also add another exemption. This is an exemption from having to become a licensed arborist for persons who remove trees that are in the process of clearing land for development, whether or not they are required to be licensed contractors. This was language that was worked out with the Construction Contractors Board. And Mr. Chair, Mike Snyder is here from the Landscape Contractors Board if you have additional questions. Just wanted to remind the committee this is not the bill that Representative Kitts has a work group on. That was the bill that allowed landscape contractors to do limited construction work without a construction contractor's license. This is a separate bill, and this is, the arborist bill. At your place this morning is one additional item, a letter from Mike Wister. He came in on the other bill. He did not come in when we did the hearing on this bill. I'm not sure he was aware of it. And Mr. Snyder might be able to address some of the comments in Mike Wister's letter. And finally, Mr. Chair, we put out some administrative rules, just for your information, that define maintenance and define gardener, because some of these terms are used in the bill to differentiate between who has to get a landscape contractor's license and who under the bill would have to get an arborist license. So if that's enough material for you, I'll stop.
Does anybody know where we're at?
Sorry. Anyway, again, just back to the bill. It creates creates a new license, new requirements to become an arborist, and consolidates the licensing under the Landscape Contractors Board. Most of these people now get construction contractors' licenses.
Mr. Chair, are we going to have any testimony or just one moment?
I'm going to have Mike come up here and talk to us.
Good morning, Chair Brown, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mike Snyder, Landscape Contractors Administrator.
Mike, help us again with this bill and what we're doing, and what does the Dash 2 do?
Chair Brown, House Bill 2097 is a bill that transfers the licensing of arborists, people that take care of trees, from the Construction Contractors Board over to the Landscape Contractors Board.
Okay.
This is a green industry type of movement. We introduced this bill on behalf of the arborists who have been trying for years to become associated with the Landscape Contractors Board rather than the Construction Contractors Board because they feel like it's a more appropriate place for them to be. And the amendments that have been given to you are referred to the amendments. How's that? That's 20972, amendments 2, is that what you call it? That are given to you is we have tried, got a call, I guess, on Tuesday from the Construction Contractors Board that they were concerned about developers. There's two types of developers that they regulate and don't regulate. One is a developer that actually supervises the construction of homes, the infrastructure of doing buildings and building homes on property. Those people have to be licensed with the Construction Contractors Board. And so those people, they want to make sure that they could do the land clearing for a development without having to be an arborist. So they have the excavators that come in, and they would be subcontracting to excavators to come in and clear land, and those people would be exempt from having to have an arborist license. There's also developers that they call soil or land developers that don't actually supervise any kind of structure. They just prepare the land for development. Those people do not have to be licensed under the CCB Construction Contractors Board, and they wanted to make sure that these people were also exempt from having to be arborists in order to come and clear land. So that is the intent of these amendments, trying to make sure that we've got everything staying consistent pretty much with what the Construction Contractors Board had for arborists versus what we're doing when we bring them over. So these are concerns that were brought over. We worked with Bill Boyd of the Construction Contractors and Craig Smith and with our Attorney General to make sure the language would cover that. So that's what that amendment does in this case, so that people that are building homes and or are doing improvements on a property, like if they have to put an put a addition on the house and a tree's in the way, they can take that tree out without having to be an arborist. So that was the intent of this.
And if they're falling trees in the woods, they aren't an arborist.
They're not.
Okay. Representative Schaffler.
Sir, thank you. Currently, even though the arborists are under the construction contractor board, do they currently, under that board, still have to meet the requirements under Section 2 to get an arborist license? Currently,
they do not have to meet the same requirements. What's happening here in this bill is we are presenting a competency part to the license. Currently, people that do tree work can get a license with the CCB without demonstrating any competency in tree care practices. A lot of the tree care people that are registered under the Construction Contractors Board also have their, what we call the International Society of Arboriculture certification. It's called an ISA certification, which is an extensive examination on how to take care of a tree, how to brace it and cable it, how to plant a tree, how to take care of those things. And that exam they have taken, many of them have taken, yes.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, if you already have one of these licenses, then are those that already have one going to be exempt from this competency test, and we're going to create a group that will not have taken this test, and then from here on out, when this comes into effect, we'll have a group that has? Is that what we're going to be doing here?
Chair Brown, Representative Schaffler, let me repeat the question, make sure I understand the question. The people that have taken the test...
No,
excuse me,
Mr.
I'm sorry.
Chair, let me just be clear. If this passes, we already have a bunch of folks out there with this license.
Yes, sir.
After this passes, will they be forced to take the competency test too, as well as those who will be applying for a new license from the effective date on?
Representative Schaffler, the people that have a construction contractor's license today and have also had the ISA certification will automatically become a landscape arborist with the Landscape Contractors Board. Those that are licensed that do not have the ISA certification will either have to take the ISA certification or pass an examination that the Landscape Contractors Board has made in order to make that happen.
All right. Well, thank you. So then is the ISA certificate is at least as rigorous as the landscaper contractor's exam will be. Is that true?
Chair Brown, Representative Schaffer. Yes, that is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Kitts.
Michael, thank you for coming here today. I had Bill Cross in my office. I had some concerns with the bill. At the time, it was yesterday, I was sicker than a dog, and still am sicker than a dog, but after looking back over the bill, I remember what my concerns were now.
Right.
I just want to know if you could address, and we've had a discussion prior, just the committee is up to speed, on the requirements to sit for the Landscape Contractors Board test as current, realizing that it's different from what we're talking about now. My concerns were that it becomes very exclusionary because of the rigid requirements to even sit for the test. Currently, if someone wants to take the Construction Contractors Board, the CCB, I could walk across the street right now and pay my fee and take that test and demonstrate a competency or not But if I do demonstrate a competency over there, I pass the test, I'm given my CCB number, I'm on my way to go do construction work. But if I wanted to walk across the street right now and take my landscape contractor's board, or what would become an arborist certification, I couldn't do that. Is that correct?
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, you are correct. Yeah, do you want me to explain that? Or
I do.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks.
Be happy to explain this.
Go ahead.
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts. The requirement for the CCB, and I'm not a CCB person, and I don't know if they're here to represent themselves or not, but the requirement to get a construction contractor license is to take a 16-hour class and to pass their exam, which is a test on business practices only. There is no testing on how to build a house, what size of 2x4 to use, what type of concrete to pour, anything that requires a competency in how to build a house. Primarily, and this is my interpretation, and I am biased by this, by the way, so I'll put that on the table for you, is that a lot of the work, most of the work that construction contractors do in building a home, they pull a permit, they have the building codes standards that they have to build this home by, and everything is inspected before it goes on to the next stage. You know, when they clear the land, when they put in the foundation, it all gets inspected and they pay a permit process to have that happen. With landscape contracting, there is no permit process in place. The people that do landscape construction are required, therefore, to take an exam that demonstrates what we consider a minimal level of competency to do the work that they're asked to do, which includes the laws and rules, of course, about having that happen, which would be very similar to what the CCB exam is. Then to know about plant ID, the type of plants, where they go, when they're supposed to be planted, what kind of soil conditions are supposed to be planted in, the preparation of that soil, the science of the soil, the grading and drainage that is required to take care of these plants. We are also authorized under our license to build water features, to pour concrete for driveways and walkways, and this type of thing, and that test includes that type of construction. We are asking questions about how to do concrete, how to do a deck, how to do a retaining wall, how to build that. So the examination gives that person a level of competency that we consider as a minimum level to go out and do that work as a landscape contractor. Now, that exam is very difficult. We have a 33% passage rate today, primarily because in our statute it requires that a person have at least 2 years experience with a licensed landscaping business or 4 years working with landscape maintenance. The question, and Representative Kitts brought this up at the hearing, is that a person that has 4 years of landscape maintenance to come in, does that make them more qualified to take the exam than, say, anybody off the street? That requirement was a compromise for people that didn't have a 2 year experience with licensed landscaping business, so they could get into this industry, so it wasn't so exclusionary. We consider the qualifications for taking our exam as being fairly minimal to pass the exam, and I think one of the reasons we have such a low rate is because we do allow people that only have a maintenance background and they haven't taken any education courses in a community college to learn their plants, to learn their construction techniques, to pass the exam. And so we still try. Our whole intent is to get people licensed to do this work. And so the person that walks off the street to come in and take that exam cannot do that. They have to meet a criteria. Now, if they don't fit into the little box, you know, there's some boxes that are done by rule. They have to, one of the things that it says in statute, that they either meet the requirements to the satisfaction of the board of education and experience to take the exam, we have people today that don't fit into that box, and we give them a right to come and appeal to the board to ask them to have the privilege to take that exam. And upon their testimony and upon what they have submitted to the board, they are allowed to sit for the exam. And the members of the board are very, very lenient on that procedure. Did I answer your question, Mr. Franklin?
Yep. Mr. Chair,
the kids.
I just, you know, just to bring to the committee's attention, I know we've all read the bill, but I guess my concern, for the record, is when you're talking about soil types and you're talking about every myriad of concern that you could have, of how short to cut your grass, when to turn off your irrigation, how to winterize your irrigation, whatever the questions may be. In my opinion, if I can pass that examination and I'm competent with soil types, levels to plant, you know, depth to plant the plants, and how to winterize, whatever it may be, if I can pass that examination, then I have to also, because it says pass an examination approved by the board and, not or, but and then section 2, 1A, have 3 years of practical experience within 10 years before I even can apply. I just think, you know, you're saying, okay, you got to pass this test. Now you've proven to us that whatever we put on this test, whatever, because you can put whatever you want on it. Now you got to go work for 3 years for somebody else that could pay you minimum wage and starve yourself for 3 years, and then you can pass the test. So I think my concern there is the same thing with the Landscape Contractors Board. I don't think that just because I go take a 16-hour class, go sit for a Construction Contractors Board, that I can go build the Street of Dreams. In theory, I could go take that class tomorrow and sit for it on Monday. I don't think I'm any qualified to build a home. But on something like this, where you can outline any concern that you have in question form and test competence at that level, and then say, now you got to work for 3 years, or vice versa, go work for 3 years and then you can take the test, or have a 4-year degree in this field. I mean, how many? I think if the committee here were to say, okay, my degree is in X, how many of that is related to what we really do in real life? I mean, that's so. That was my concern. It's still my concern. I just don't understand, I guess, to go out and work for minimum wage for 3 years and then somehow say, okay, now I can sit and qualify for the test. That's my concern. So thank you for hearing my concern.
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, and I'm not the one that wrote this language, but the ISA examination requires a certain amount of experience before they can take that exam. And so I think that's where this language came from, is that before they do the application, it says 3 years practical experience in arboriculture. Before they can take the ISA examination, they have to have a certain amount of experience in order to do that. And so that is where this language came from. Before our exam would be applied, they would have to have 3 years of education or experience in the field before they could take the exam that the board was going to give. Or they could have in section 2, I mean, paragraph 2 of that, it says, or obtain the ISA certification. So that makes the requirements similar to the ISA certification.
Mr. Chair, follow up. Just as a parallel, it doesn't surprise me that the industry supports this. I mean, why wouldn't they? I mean, that's like maybe an incumbent state rep saying, before you can run against me, you have to go down and work for me or one of my colleagues for 3 years, and then I think you're qualified. That to me, that's the parallel. So me as an incumbent in the business or a business, why wouldn't I support that? I mean, it seems like it starts to keep people out or at least make things very difficult at the expense of the little guy trying to get into a business. That's my perception. We can disagree on it. I'm not asserting there's a vast right or left wing conspiracy in this case. I'm just simply saying that the appearance to me is, of course, the industry would support it. That doesn't get me there saying it must be a good bill then. So that's just my concern.
Representative Shoffley.
I had a lawn maintenance business for 5 years. I have a contractor's license, and I have a degree in political science.
And you couldn't put in your own irrigation system.
So here I am. Anyway, the reason I say all that is, it's kind of just joking about my qualifications, but, you know, a lot of people spend a lot of money on their stuff, on their trees and their shrubs, a lot of money. And what this does is protects that investment. And I've been on people's property where people had butchered a tree or a shrub or the landscape or wrecked their irrigation somehow. I've seen it happen several times. And then I was asked to come help them, or just happen to witness it, see it there, and they complained to me about it. So I definitely, it's just like if you're a dentist, you have to be qualified, you have to have experience, education, you have to show competency. That's what I think, that's what we're trying to get at here, to protect the consumer. And yeah, I believe the industry does want to make sure there's competent people out there, and it probably will help their trade, make them look better, because the fewer people out there that are screwing up, the easier it is for them when they step on somebody's yard to hopefully gain confidence and get a job. And the hardest thing a contractor has is, once you walk on that property, is to get them to feel comfortable with you to go to work for them. And that is a big leap, believe me, because you're trusting these people with your property and your money. So I think that's what you're trying to get at here. Am I correct on that?
Chair Brown, Representative Shoffler, that is correct. Landscape industry has struggled for years to gain confidence of the public, and it's been the industry's desire to completely upgrade the perception of the industry. Perception is 98% of what people feel. We are trying to make competency again. We get a minimal level of competency. It doesn't guarantee everything is going to be correct. It's our job as an agency to make sure that if they have that minimal level of competency, that when they do go out and practice, that we are protecting the consumer with the bond and the insurance and everything else that comes.
And very briefly, Mr. Chair, you know, when I got my contractor's license, it was easier than it is now. And I'm not against the board or anything like that, but they still don't ask if I can read a tape measure,
correct,
a level, a plumb bob, or a square.
Correct.
Maybe there is some measurement in there. I can't remember, but the last three, I know they didn't. But I'm allowed to go out and work on million-dollar homes, or, you know, repair or put in some kind of concrete structure or whatever. So I think their competency, their requirements of competency probably could go up a little bit. But I don't want to get into that. We'll have the room full of people yelling at me. I mean, Chair, thank you.
Representative
Kiff. Chair, one follow-up with Representative Shoffler. The concerns that he brought up regarding consumer protection, I think, are valid ones. It's why I have a bill that would require maintenance folks to be registered with the state so we know who they are, and require those folks to have minimal insurance coverage. So I think, from my perspective, they're two separate issues. I agree with putting those parameters in, which is why I've got those bills that are in the process and probably coming to this committee and been working with Mike on those. And so I just think it's two different issues.
Okay. The way I understand this bill, the first intent of this bill is to move the arborists from where they're at now to the landscape contracting board. The discussion we've been hearing is about the standards that are being set also in this bill at this time.
That's correct, Chair Brown.
Representative Kitts, would you be willing to work with Mike and develop some an amendment that would be more acceptable to you?
More than happy to.
Okay.
If Mike's willing to work with me.
Happy to do that, sir.
All right.
Which Mike?
Representative Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to state Representative Shoffler's comments. I don't know many laborers that know how to read tape measures and operate plumb bobs.
I'm unique in many ways, Mr. Chair.
But anyway, I did have a small question about the person that is engaged in commercial harvesting of forest products not being, required to have one of these arboriculture licenses or an arborist license. So I'm just trying to get clear. So I have a friend that's an ex-or that's a logger, works for a logging company, and I have a couple of trees that I need to have fell on my property. Does he need to have a license as an arborist to do that?
You're correct. Chair Brown, Representative Fulvey, yes, he would need to have a license to come onto your property and fall those trees. If he was, if I'm reading this bill correctly, the intent of this is if people are doing tree harvesting out in the woods, or if they're doing Christmas trees, the commercial harvesting of lumber, they do not need an arborist license. But if you're going to go onto people's property and to fall trees or to prune trees, you will need an arborist license.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mike.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2097. And Janet, do we have anything else? I don't think we made much progress today. We spun our wheels for 2 hours. Is there anything else? Committee have anything else? Seeing none, we are adjourned.